one thing. My son has been instructed not to interrupt me, but I can't quite tell my dogs. One dog loves to jump. He's a big golden retriever, but he jumps and tries to give me hugs.
When he has something to say, we'll have to let him say it when he's ready then, whether he's asked a question or not. So this is Robert Rogers from Parkinson's Recovery. Welcome to this particular and very special session where we're going to be interviewed a very well-known author and person who knows everything there is to know about meditation and Zen and lots of other fascinating subjects. And I want to introduce first a woman who is well known in her own right, Nancy Wells from Bellingham, Washington, who is going to be interviewing our special guest. So, Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. And it's my honor and privilege to introduce Dr. Paula Arai. Dr. Arai, I know that you are, I believe, currently on sabbatical doing some writing. Is that correct? But usually you teach at the University of Louisiana?
Yes, Louisiana State University.
Louisiana State, okay. Did I get that right about your writing sabbatical? Yes.
I'm fortunate to have a grant and time to write.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? And yes. My understanding is you're writing about your experience actually living in a woman's Zen monastery in Japan and studying there the Zen nuns' healing rituals. Is that correct?
Well, I wrote my first book on Zen nuns after having lived with them, and this particular project, though, builds on that, and being a field researcher and having a child, it was a little hard to stay in the nunnery, so now I'm working primarily with lay women.
I see.
But with lay women who are affiliated with the Zen nunnery. They consider the nunnery and the nuns there their teachers, and so it is a community that with monastic and lay members, but I'm primarily focusing on what the women, the lay women do in their homes, which is a very different kind of Zen than the monastic Zen.
Yes, it's that's exciting because that's the kind of Zen I practice. My guiding teacher is Norman Fisher, who you may or may not heard of, but his whole project is called Everyday Zen, where he actually goes around the world teaching that Zen is an everyday thing. It's not necessarily a monastic practice, and in fact, he's encouraging more and more Zen practitioners in the United States to stop focusing on the monastery, you know, as the only place to truly practice Zen, but that you can do it in your everyday life. So it sounds like that's what you're exploring now, too. And I'm wondering, are you doing that here with women in the States or in Japan or both?
Well, my field research is with women in Japan, and so the rituals are, tailored to Japanese culture. But one of the things the abbess, Aoyama Shundo Roshi, who's written Zen Seeds that's been translated into English, one thing she always said that practice, if you think you're too busy to practice, you don't know what practice is. It isn't, you know, you have to go get in the lotus posture and sit still. Of course, practice can be that, but it can also be, you know, cooking soup and cleaning the floors and driving along the road. It's more about how you approach what you're doing than
specific
content. So when I was working with the nuns, you know, I saw all these rituals and all these things that were not found in Zen philosophical texts or in a lot of the research, secondary research done. And with Japanese society having changed so much since the beginning of last century, the 20th century, I realized that the things that these women do in their homes, the resources, the wisdom they've developed over, you know, many, many generations, that there is a significant shift taking place, and their daughters aren't even learning many of the things that these women, they were all elderly women, have learned. And so to be able to work with them and listen to them, find out what they're doing, they have things that I do see, you know, certainly work in their own lives, but I can see how it can help many people. And one of the keys is being creative and tailoring things to your own specific needs. So even if the ritual aesthetics and, you know, things that are said, the chants are in Japanese, there's no reason that they can't, someone can't figure out a way to make it meaningful in their own linguistic and cultural context.
I know that you are somewhat aware from, I think, what I told you, the book that Robert and I are focusing on has to do with whether meditation can be used as a coping response to chronic pain and illness. And I realize that there's a lot of ways of suffering. As the Buddha said, it's not simply physical suffering. There's also emotional and mental and relationship suffering. And I'm wondering, when what in your studies, what does healing mean in a Zen Buddhist context that you've studied?
Well, healing means that you stop suffering. So in a sense, it's no different than the most basic Buddhist goal to be enlightened, which means to stop suffering or to actualize wisdom and compassion in your daily life. And so healing doesn't mean cure. It doesn't, although it can involve curing, it's more how to not be tormented by the situations that you're in. And so what I saw when I first was trying to understand what these women meant by healing, the word healing actually doesn't translate well into colloquial Japanese. And so I had to ask, you know, what do you do when things aren't going well? And what helps you? And find out what did help mean? And even though I'm a Buddhist scholar, I was just listening openly. And then when I started analyzing and interpreting everything that you've been telling me over the last decade, it turned out that it's actually very much in accord with the, you know, root basic Buddhist teachings of called the three poisons. And when I have formulated it in the way that they stress it, that healing means to stop suffering from delusion that we are separate or that we're alone. That feeling alone, feeling like, you know, you're overwhelmed with something that not just these women, but I imagine many people, you know, that's one of the worst things, is to feel like you're alone.
Yeah,
and so many
helpless,
Right, and so many of the rituals are about how do you feel connected.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part of healing, in their words, is to stop desiring things that are not possible, whether that be that your cancer immediately goes away or that your child starts acting responsibly, that, you know, things that are, you know, you can't control, to not keep, you know, ramming your head into the wall trying to make it happen if it's beyond your control. So stop wanting those things. And, you know, to accept that there's a whole lot going on out there that you may not be able, you don't have all the pieces, so you can't see clearly what may be the best thing, and so to try and relax. And this is another, in the situation where you're not able to get the things that you want. And many of the rituals there, again, kind of help you learn how to breathe and to be in the situation, not wanting it to be different than it is. The third aspect, to stop being angry about things that you do not like. And, you know, this is a cousin to the one before, not desiring things that are not possible. But, you know, to have, you know, being upset and frustrated and even, you know, it turning into bitterness and resentment, that, you know, that's not healing. If you can stop being angry, that you can actually use that power and energy of the anger to transform it into energy of how to integrate things, and not be judgmental, saying, oh, I like this, I don't like this, or this is good, this is bad. Because the narrower, you know, you have to have a narrow perspective or a narrower work perspective to assess that something's good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a really, really large perspective, then things don't fall along those lines of good, bad, like, don't like. And again, here, the women have several rituals that do help them expand their perspective. So, you know, the rituals help you feel connected. They help you find breathing room when you're dealing with situations that you want it to be different, and they help you expand your perspective large enough that you don't get yourself all tied up and stuck into thinking this is good, this is bad. And the most striking thing about that's not necessarily shared across all Buddhist traditions, but that in this particular Soto Zen version of Buddhism, that really struck me was that healing only happens in the present moment. And that took my breath away once I realized that this is what they were talking about, that it's not like you do rituals or do things in order to eventually heal at
mm-hmm.
some point in the future, but that that healing, you know, you can experience healing, you know, in any given moment. And, you know, 10 minutes later you could be, you know, racked with pain, and then also, you know, your mind can, you know, torture yourself with wanting it to go away or wanting something that isn't there, not wanting something that's there. And then you can then again, you know, do some rituals that help you breathe and it's not so bad anymore. That you get a different relationship to your circumstances, whether that's a different relationship to the pain or different relationships to the people around you. That healing, that's what struck me most, that
uh-huh.
I learned from these women, is how healing is, you know, something of the present moment, and it can come and go. And
that certainly makes sense when you think of the suffering being, I think most people suffer in a sense because we have imagination, and we can imagine what it would be like without our illness.
Right.
And we could, and we have memory, and we can remember perhaps
right.
what it was like without our illness or pain.
Right. Right.
And so living in that past or that present or that imagination of the future is extremely painful, and
yes.
and you certainly aren't living in the moment right now and seeing what can I do right now to ease my suffering. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the rituals that you studied and observed in Japan that the women do.
Yeah.
I realize some will be quite perhaps foreign to some of us here in the United States, because of course Japan has you know, their own culture, but would you mind talking about some of those rituals and how you noticed they helped?
Yeah, I'd be delighted. The the most striking aspect of what I've called this, developed this concept in my own mind, I'm calling this domestic Zen. My first book was all about monastic Zen, which is the one that most people are familiar with. And the characteristics and qualities and aims of this kind of Zen were different enough that I wanted to call them domestic Zen.
Mm-hmm.
And in my own mind, that's almost like an oxymoron.
Mm-hmm.
because the domestic sphere is messy and emotional, and it's people are, you know, trying to work things out, not necessarily in, you know, a clean, calm, serene manner, which is the hallmark, at least, of the ideals of the Zen monastery and the popularized version of Zen, you know, that it's all, you know, calm and balanced. That's not what happens necessarily even in a monastery, but
no.
It's even more not so in the domestic sphere. And what the women described as like the anchor or the harbor of their way of practicing or living Zen is called a butsudan, or a home Buddhist altar.
Mm-hmm.
There is a space in the home that people can turn to make offerings or to chant or to pray. And in a Japanese Buddhist altar, most of them, the understanding is when a family member has passed away that death is a way to become enlightened. And so the deceased is understood to be a Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way this works in the lives of these women is they continue the relationships with the deceased, but they are transformed. The, you know, the deceased being recognized as a Buddha, you know, all the complications, the idiosyncrasies, the past bad memories, you know, have fade away, and they can turn to that person who is now understood to be a Buddha as what I've called, I'm calling a personal Buddha, that there's this, you know, specific Buddha who knows everything about you and can listen to you, can be there for you. And so that person is seen to be the Buddha in the home altar. And you can actually have more than one, of course. There can be more than one deceased member, and, you know, people will usually have, you know, a Shakyamuni Buddha or an Amida Buddha in there as well. But the relationship is really with the particular person who has passed away that that you may go talk with them, and, you know, to have someone who listens to you as patiently and as deeply as you know, your own personal Buddha, you know, is very powerful healing when you can feel you're understood and not judged. And so going to that home altar, and for some women it's, you know, they can even have a whole room dedicated to it, all the way to, you know, they just have a little bit of a corner on the top of their bureau,
mm-hmm.
and have a picture, and they may light some incense, some, give some flowers, or even just a little tiny cup of tea. And to have a place where you can go to be understood, that's safe. And, you know, that's a very big part of domestic Zen. Also, to make the offerings is a chance for you to get beyond yourself a little bit. A lot of suffering comes from, you know, getting too focused on yourself in kind of a pinpointed way, and everything
mm-hmm.
gets distorted through a pinpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's hard to keep your balance when the wind starts blowing if you're only balancing on a pinpoint.
Yeah, sure. That's a good metaphor. I like that.
So, you know, when you can, you know, even if it's just giving a cup of tea to someone else, that, you know, can open you up. It's an opportunity to make a connection where then there maybe are two pinpoints and it's better balance. And then the chanting, what I've seen, so the offerings help you, you know, make these generous gestures that have you think beyond yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the chanting, quite literally, you know, you breathe. Where, you know, if you're chanting and, you know, you're doing a whole lot of exhaling as you're chanting, and it just slows everything down, all the stress that can just build up, you know, when you're chanting, the whole body gets a chance to relax and breathe more deeply. And so it gives you that breathing space, quite literally. And then prayer, where either you're praying because you're talking as a form of talking to your personal Buddha about the problems that you have, it's a chance for you to kind of pull your own energy together, not in the pinpoint itself, but you've made connections to something larger than yourself. And when holding your hands together in prayer, or in gassho in Japanese, that actually kind of completes the electrical circuit in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so when your hands are separated, the energy scatters. But when you are sitting in prayer with your hands together, your energy has a chance to collect and gather and get stronger, because it's not getting dissipated. It has a chance to build up in this very safe place at the home altar. And those are daily ritualized activities that the women do that, you know, helps them keep their balance. They're steadier through things with just those activities. That's the mainstay of domestic Zen ritual practices. And most of these women do not meditate, unlike in Zen as it's been brought to the United States, that where even lay people will do a lot of zazen or seated meditation practice. You know, that certainly can be very helpful, but that's not very common in domestic Zen in Japan. And
I noticed here that that they find chanting and breathing better than meditating at getting calm and clear and centered. So it's much more an active process, it sounds like.
Right. And when, you know, you've got other things going on around the house, it's not a monastery,
mm-hmm.
you know, other people are moving around. One woman says she always does her chanting in the morning, specifically when everybody's leaving to go to school or work. And she's right actually by the door that everyone's leaving out, right by the front door. And so she's yelling, "Don't forget your lunch," and she's chanting, and, you know, "I'm not going to be home, make sure to take your key." And so she does that specifically, she said, so everyone else in the family knows there's this harbor that they can go to. Because she doesn't think it's effective to just tell them, you know, "You can do this."
Mm-hmm.
But she shows them by doing it. And it creates an ethos in the home and in the human relations to, you know, to not, I think of them as like it's brakes on keeping you from going too quickly back to that pinpoint itself.
Mm-hmm.
That there are things that can slow you down and keep you connected and aware of how you are interconnected, which is the prime quality in these women's healing paradigm, is to experiencing interrelatedness. We can all think, you know, with our heads, "Oh yes, you know, the trees become paper, and you know, I'm holding this paper, and the trees grew because of the rain," and all that Thich Nhat Hanh said so wonderfully. We can all think about that, how we're interrelated, but that won't heal you. You have to feel it. You have to, you know, it has to be an experience that you're interconnected. And so these rituals that I described to you are the basis of the basic ones for feeling interconnected. There are several more. I don't know how you want to move this conversation.
Well, one thing I was wondering, just because of our audience, is could you see interpreting these rituals in, let's say, a United States domestic environment where chanting might not be necessarily something that they're real familiar with, although prayer might be? And, of course, you know, I've found a lot of similarity between the chanting that I do during Zen practice and the praying that I did as a child, that there mm-hmm. that there is that kind of comfort. But I'm wondering if there's a way, you know, you could advise like American women who are suffering and need that healing space to.
And
I'm kind of jumping around here too, but I'm also wondering. You mentioned putting a picture of the deceased one as your mm-hmm. own personal Buddha, and is that connected to the Japanese ancestor worship, or am I confusing that with Chinese? Or
no, I mean they got it from the Chinese, and mm-hmm. it is coming out of the same kind of cultural worldview matrix. So the ancestral rites are done through Buddhism in Japan, and they're done more through Confucianism. And, well, these isms are, you know, an academic categories and distinctions that in the real world, it's never so neat. But, yeah, it does come out of China and in Japan. But there is no other Buddhist culture that thinks of the deceased as a Buddha. That's distinctive to Japanese Buddhism.
Okay, so that's very unique to this particular form of Buddhism.
Yeah. Well, one thing, you know, getting back to what would translate into the American context, one of the practices that the women do, you can call it, say, mantra practice, that there are a couple of different phrases that, you know, while running to the doctors when your child's probably broken their arm, or spiked a fever in the middle of the night, or you're just, you know, terrified waiting for your diagnosis to come to you the next day and you can't sleep, that the one of the chants or mantras is Namu Kan no Liki, which means praise to the power of the Bodhisattva of compassion, which, you know, it's a mouthful in English, but some kind of short phrase that would be meaningful to yourself or if you're in a community that you could, because, you know, coming up with something yourself can be very powerful because it, you know, it hits the spot. You know exactly what's going to come through. And if you can get some short phrase, or there's also a power, a distinct power that comes when a community has decided, even if the community is you and your best friend, you decide, okay, we're going to, you come up with a phrase that the key is in this kind of mantra is that it helps you feel connected to something bigger than yourself.
I see.
And,
right.
And it helps, because that business of feeling alone, I mean, that's tenacious, and you got to keep reminding yourself that you really aren't. And so to have something you've decided ahead of time is connecting you to something larger. It's meaningful to you. You have a worldview that, like there is some power out there, compassionate power, that's there for you. And then you can, you know, it's just quite simple. You're just chanting it usually under your breath or even silently if you don't want anyone else to know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're sitting in an emergency room or something, that you can be doing that. So, because at those times when it's so intense, you can't really think straight. And it's about trying to, you know, find the balance in that situation. Uh-huh. And so to have something that makes you feel connected, not just you cerebrally know, but you're familiar with it enough that it feels like, yes, I am connected.
Yeah,
and
I'm not really alone. There's really, there's comfort and compassion right here for me now if I let myself feel it.
Right now, and that is the point, that it is, you know, that's what in domestic Zen, you know, it's all about what pragmatic, direct, rather immediate meeting of your needs. And it's not, you know, different women do different things. They create their own stuff. You know, one woman was given, albeit by the Abbess, a cleaning cloth. Now, Japan is a big gift-giving culture, and so there's people want to give gifts that are practical because nobody can, you know, get, you know, a bunch of stuff that they don't need, especially in a small home. So giving things that, you know, soap or detergent, you know, things that you can use up that you can pretty much be assured everyone's going to use. And so anyways, the Abbess gave out these cleaning cloths that she had helped write the calligraphy and had a Buddhist artist paint on it. And, you know, it was pretty nice, and you could use it actually for a cleaning cloth, but most women thought of it as something very special from the Abbess. This one woman who received one, she was given a diagnosis of cancer. The medical doctor said that they could do nothing more for her, and she took that cleaning cloth and had one laid on her pillow, and her husband had another one he'd been given. She laid on the legs the site of her cancer, and she just felt embraced by this compassion, and that she was okay. Not that she was going to be okay, but that she was okay. And it was over 14 years ago, and the doctors have not been able to detect the cancer. It's gone.
Wow.
And so, you know, she just made that up, and now it's, you know, a thing in this community that, you know, if you're sick, get one of these cleaning cloths.
That's great.
But that was never the intention of the Abbess. And this, you know, I'm telling you this because there aren't any rules. I mean, if it works for you, it works.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. So it has to be something that's meaningful to you. And, you know, since we are in this point of things are transferring across culture, there is a little bit more of a forethought, deliberate decision-making dimension that you wouldn't find in a culture that, you know, grew up with it or, and developed it. But the qualities, you know, you'd look for, as I've said, something that, you know, first of all speaks to your own heart and your own situation, something that makes you viscerally feel connected beyond yourself, something that makes you feel safe, even in your most vulnerable, desperate situation, that you feel safe, that there's some bigger power. And something, you know, in general, it's something simple, not elaborate, something you can do as you're, you know, running to the doctors or, you know, so distraught you can't, you know, put, you know, 2 cents together. So that those are the qualities in the domestic Zen ritual practices.
It seems like the main focus is this sort of gathering of yourself back into the present moment, the realization that you're not alone and that you can get through this, whatever it is, whether it be waiting for the doctor's diagnosis or the, you know, the pain at the moment that you're experiencing through your disease, that somehow there can be a way to almost bring a kind of, not a cure, but a comfort to yourself. Am I hearing you right, that you can take comfort from that sense of not being alone and of breathing, of calming, of being clear with yourself that you're not all by yourself suffering like this? There's other people out there who'd understand.
Yeah, and there is a universe supporting you. I mean, you know, down to the basics of, you know, our bodies have carbon and, you know, the stars have carbon. You know, we're part of something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a Japanese verb, tsukiyau, which means to have friendly interactions with someone, you know, on an active basis. Not, you know, a friend you only see once every 10 years, but someone you know, you may go have coffee with, you know, as often as you can. And so this verb is used with how are you going to tskiao, how are you going to have this interactive, friendly relationship with your situation. So if it's with your cancer or with your chronic hip pain, it's, you know, how do you become friends with it? That if everything's interrelated, there can't be enemies. And so it's not about attacking or wanting to get rid of something. It's about how do you make friends with it. And if you're trying to make friends and then realize, okay, my pain's not so bad if I don't feel like I've got to go, you know, walk 2 miles a day. You know, on days it hurts, I'll just walk 1 mile or maybe just a block and make friends with it because, you know, you're together with it. It's not something outside that you need to fight against. And so they say the key is, you know, how do you interact? How friendly are you with your whatever the situation is, and to not resist it. It takes a lot of energy to resist. Mm-hmm. And by accepting it, it doesn't mean you throw in the towel and say, okay, well, you win. It's not like that. It's just, okay.
Yeah, it's not giving up. No.
No.
It's, you know, when you say make friends with your pain, with your illness, with, I remember, I've been sick for a very long time, and I remember people saying that, especially my parents who are very Catholic, you know, that they have, Catholics have a way of saying, well, this is your cross to bear. You should be, in a sense, you know, proud that God gave you this. And I could just, all I could think is, you idiots, because I wasn't in that place, or they weren't able to explain to me that by making friends doesn't mean I accept it and go, oh, I love this pain, but rather, okay, this is something I can learn from. I'm not sure what yet, and it's something I can share. I've certainly learned this over the years, something I can share with others who didn't know they could have anybody else to talk to about it and thought they weren't supposed to talk about it. And, you know, so that kind of sharing and intimacy is what I think is the kind of how I interpret making friends with your illness. It doesn't mean, yeah, that you, oh, I'm so glad I got this. I mean, maybe someday I can get there, but I wouldn't expect other, you know, that wouldn't be an expectation I'd have of other people. But I would, if I was working with them, you know, in a treatment capacity or in a teaching meditation with illness capacity, is to help them see that it doesn't necessarily have to be your enemy. You're right. It is all related. So how can it really be, you know, out to get you when it's you?
Right.
It's part of you. Uh-huh.
Yeah. That those concepts of like, do not like, good, bad, enemy, that they are just concepts, but they have so much power to shape how we experience things. And one of the keys that to this healing paradigm is to change your perspective. If you are suffering, that means your perspective is too narrow, too small. And so maybe it should be, I could call it expanding perspective. The more you expand it, it's like, you know, to take a different metaphor from the pinpoints, if you're, say, out on a raft and you hit some white water, and just your lone little raft, you know, it's so easy to topple over. But if, you know, if there are a bunch of people with rafts and then you all time together, and then you have a bigger network that can then ride the waves and doesn't get tumbled over.
Right.
And so, you know, whatever will work for you to have that sense that I am now, you know, tied together with whatever else, whether it's other people or feeling connected to nature or, you know, to the cosmos, whatever will help you feel that connection to something broader. And the bigger it gets, the less suffering.
Mm-hmm.
There's just more stability.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so difficult to be balanced.
Yeah,
the narrower
it makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Yeah, the narrower the perspective, it is so much more difficult to find your balance and to maintain it through all the vicissitudes of what goes on in life.
Yeah, it's so, like trying to just balance on one foot.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to do that for too long.
Right. And it's really, it's almost like you're actually connected to all these other things, and you just don't realize it, and so it's in your head you're standing on one foot and alone, but in reality you actually are already connected.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, how do you access that? How do you feel that, you know, down to your marrow? How do you feel that you are connected? And another phenomenon has been that, you know, people going into surgery before they go under anesthesia, someone will hand them a rock that says "daijoubu," which in Japanese means, you know, it's okay. And So, you know, people going into surgery holding these rocks that, you know, say it's okay. And it's not saying you're absolutely going to get through this with flying colors.
It seems to me that it would be a reminder that somebody is thinking of you, caring for you, waiting for you. That whole idea of giving a gift to hold, it's like, here's a piece of me, hold on to it through this this tough
and
time.
And a piece of the earth.
Right.
You know,
that
a
too.
Reminder that there's
something. Yeah, not just, I'm sorry, yeah, not just one person, but the whole, yeah, the whole universe sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, so if you can see a rock that way, then it will have more power to help you find the balance and not suffer. And, you know, so whatever, you know, works, there may be something, you know, in your family that would have that power to make you immediately and viscerally feel that kind of connection. So, you know, those kinds of things, I think, you know, anybody in any culture could find something that's helpful.
How can people get in touch with your writings and your book and the books that are coming out? Could you give us some information on that? Because we want to make sure that our readers can follow up on this, because this is fascinating stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the title, maybe you mentioned that already, but the title of your first book and then also when the others might be coming out?
Well, the first book was called Women Living Zen.
Women Living Zen, okay.
Uh-huh. Japanese Buddhist nuns in Japan, it's a key world, so I put it on the word.
That's okay. You know, once you write it, you forget about it. I understand that.
So it's Japanese Soto Buddhist Nuns. That's the title.
Okay.
And that's out by Oxford. You can get it on Amazon, and I'm embarrassed to say it's an outrageous price, and I'm working on getting it in paperback. But hopefully you get it at least in the library. And the book that I'm working on now is called Healing Zen, Japanese Buddhist Women's Rituals of Transformation. And that one I'm working with University of Hawaii Press, because they'll have better prices. But, you know, it probably is, fall of 2010 before it's going to be on the shelves. I have a few articles here and there, covering the personal Buddhas and Zen rituals. There's a book called Zen Rituals or something, edited by Stephen Hine, H-E-I-N-E, that has some of this material.
And do you have your own website, perhaps, with these titles on it, or?
No. I haven't gotten that high tech yet.
I just laugh because I'm not either. I'm just learning how to work an iPod.
Yeah. So you know, this material hasn't. You know, it's still in progress, and it isn't out there in full yet.
Well, what our plan is once Robert and I transcribe these dialogues and edit them, we'll send them back to you, back to each interviewee to sort of vet it and make sure that, yes, this is what I said, and that would also give us a chance to put, you know, exactly, you know, the title of your book, the publisher, when it came out, when it will come out, you know, that sort of thing. Because I think that would be really important to include. You're doing us a tremendous, you're giving us a tremendous gift here with your knowledge and with, you know, talking to, you know, the people who are listening in. A lot of them are, of course, Parkinson's patients, since this is a Parkinson's recovery program, but we've had questions and other people with all different kinds of illnesses listen in, and of course have interviewed many different people who work with many different kinds of illnesses, including you know, we're going to be looking at mental health and or mental illness, not just physical illness, and so you know, looking at suffering from all these different perspectives is just is a tremendous gift, and I just really appreciate you talking with us like this.
Well, I want to say that the women, the elderly, the elder Japanese Buddhist lay women in Japan, you know, they entrusted me with their wisdom and their stories, their pains, their vulnerability, because they wanted some, you know, if they could say anything to help anyone else, they wanted to. And so I'm, you know, their messenger, that, and I'm honored that they would trust me with this.
And, yeah, that's a beautiful thing, yeah.
So it's really, you know, they are the ones who have, you know, learned this, many of them, the hard way. And, you know, they thought, many of them thought they may pass on before they could ever share it. And so I think it's wonderful that you're doing this to be able to help more people learn.
Well, Robert and I have talked about how some of the Parkinson's people he works with have often said, you know, well, how can I meditate when my body's so, you know, when it's tremoring, or when it's so, you know, it's so difficult to work with. And what I've learned about meditation over the years, and of course working with meditation as a physically limited person, is you work with what you've got. You know, that you don't, you know, like you don't have to sit lotus. You don't have to sit on a cushion. You can sit in a chair. You can do whatever it takes to bring you to that calm, centered, connected place where you don't feel so alone and so afraid and so full of that suffering. And so it's this is, you know, you're helping a tremendous amount of people, which means the women who have talked to you are helping a tremendous amount of people. So maybe we can just keep it going on and on, and get the news out that there's a whole lot of different ways of coping with this bodily suffering, this emotional suffering that we happen to be in this world, and this is powerful stuff.
Well, yeah. Well, one of the things that an insight that came to me listening to these women talking about how, you know, they're like a cell in the universe, or when they're feeling really bad, they try and think of themselves as being 5 billion years old, I had a thought in hearing that, you know, you can't fall off the universe. There's nowhere to go. You can't fall off.
Uh-huh.
And as the because you couldn't fall off. Well, that must mean I belong.
Uh-huh.
And feeling like you belong, and you're part of something so big, there's no way you can't get off it. was one of the ways that I, you know, could feel whenever I felt like maybe I'm, you know, alone and starting to feel sorry for myself, and I realized, well, you know, it's not like I can go anywhere else. I mean, you can't leave the universe.
Which almost means that it's holding you up. It's embracing you.
Right. And so they talk about how when you, to heal is actually to wake up to realizing you're already healed. You just wake up that you're already healed because the universe is already supporting you. And so, you know, to whatever it takes for you to change your perspective so you see those things clearly enough or feel those things. And I should say when, like when the women are giving offerings or doing, you know, there are a whole host of rituals done in temples that are for ancestor commemoration, that these women are not doing them in order to heal. They're just doing them to commemorate their ancestors. Mm. And so the experience of healing is really a byproduct because, in a sense, you know, the deepest healing comes from knowing that you're completely interconnected and you're already healed. But to aim at, okay, I'm going to feel that I'm completely interconnected to everything, and then I'm going to, you know, that'll help me heal.
And then I'll be cured, and I won't need to be connected.
Well, no, but it's a target so big that as soon as you conceptualize it, it becomes smaller.
Uh-huh.
And so it has to be a bodily experience. And so
if it's
just lighting a candle or lighting an incense or just putting your hands together and bowing to the sunset, that there's a part of it that you can't be too cerebral about it. You just have to do it in your body. And, you know, you could call all those things meditations. I don't. I call them ritualized activities and see meditation as a kind of ritualized behavior and not the other way around, because there's so much pressure on people to meditate and it sounds so hard and it's, you know, people feel bad that they're not doing it or not doing it well enough, or and there comes a lot of psychological baggage with talking about meditation. And it's really, you know, it's a different cultural context, of course, but, you know, in the Japanese context, people don't think in those terms. They, you know, have these smaller, uncumbersome activities throughout the day in a way of seeing and feeling. And, you know, that'll take a long time, I think, for it to make more of a headway in the U.S. culture. But perhaps, you know, I want to take the pressure off people who feel like, oh, I'm not a good meditator and therefore I'm not going to be able to benefit. From this, one of the studies that I'm beginning to work on with a neuroscientist at the Salk Institute, Sasha Dulac, is there have been, you know, now increasing studies on the meditating brain, and those are wonderful. But again, because of, you know, that sense of pressure people feel and, you know, inadequacy, that they're not doing it well enough, and the vast majority of Buddhists throughout Buddhist history have not meditated, but they have done rituals. And you know, I'm not a scientist, but I was trying to think like one and said, okay, we got to try and isolate some particular activity. And I thought, okay, what about bowing? Why don't we look at bowing? So I, you know, called Sasha up at the Salk and said, well, why don't we look at bowing? Because meditation also gets so quickly cerebral, and I, you know, when I've found in my work that healing is, you know, something you got to do with your body, even though healing has a lot to do with how you perceive and interpret things, the body is perceiving and interpreting as well, and So we're starting to look at what happens to the body. Like when I was mentioning you put your hands together in prayer and closing off the electrical circuit, that you, when you bow also, you know, if you think about it, you know, as animals, an animal that bows down and can't see what's going around, going on around it, you know, that's a very vulnerable position to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And
very trusting.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in order to do it voluntarily, you have to feel like you are in a safe place. And so, you know, the opposite of the fight or flight cascade of chemical and electrical things that go on in the body, that we're beginning to wonder if you are deliberately, as an animal, choosing to bow down, that are you perhaps starting a different cascade? And we're looking perhaps at oxytocin, whether that increases as you're feeling safer and connected, and hopefully one of the key, actually, parts of the healing paradigm of these women that I haven't mentioned yet is gratitude, that that's a shortcut to healing. That so if you're bowing down in gratitude, so you're physically bowing, not just thinking about it, you're physically bowing down, so your body knows, okay, I'm in a vulnerable position, but it's okay to be like this. And then you're setting these different things off in the body, perhaps. I mean, we haven't done the research yet, but this
mm-hmm.
what we're thinking is going on. And when you're cultivating or experience that sense of gratitude, when you are, you know, when you're bowing in gratitude, when you're grateful, you can't complain. When you're grateful, anger just doesn't even come.
Right. It's hard to carry both at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah. Right. And so that's perhaps something that people here could do is just come up with your own ritual. And I would advocate, although the research isn't done yet, but I would, since Buddhists have been bowing, you know, for a couple thousand years, and they haven't, most of them have not been meditating all these years, I'm thinking there must be something to it. People wouldn't keep doing it
mm-hmm.
if there wasn't something. And I'm thinking, you know, if people would incorporate a kind of bowing and with a sense of gratitude, it doesn't have to involve any words. They just physically have to put their hands together and, you know, bow their head down, whether they're standing or sitting or, you know, if they can't get their hands together, even, you know, crossing your legs or having some part of the body, you know, the two different sides of the body touching, two hands, two feet, somehow connecting. That you know, the lotus posture is essentially all about getting the both sides of the body connected, but it doesn't have to be, you know, that more complex connection. It can be as simple as touching side to side. And you know, not against meditation whatsoever, but seeing, you know, the Buddhist cultures in different contexts, in different historical time periods, this is a distinct development in Buddhist history that you get so many lay people thinking they need to meditate in order to be Buddhist or in order to benefit from Buddhist practice.
And here you're offering a whole different array of things that can do, in a sense, bring about the same result as what we all think meditation will do, which is to, you know, bring you to the present moment and calm you and clear your head. And so you can do other things, too. You don't just have to sit and sit still.
Yeah, and most of these women don't have time to. So it's when they're, you know, people in Japan don't usually have dryers, and so when the sun's out and they go, oh, good, I can get the sheets dry.
Wow.
You know, and they, you know, just to have that sense of, as they're hanging the sheet to dry, that, you know, thank you, sun. You know, I'm so happy to see you today.
Yeah.
And it's in that taking those little things that have to be done every and seeing them as how you're already supported by the universe, seeing how you're already connected, you belong. You know, when you're cutting carrots for a soup, you know, to thank the carrot as you're cutting it. And, you know, it's those things that are interwoven through daily activities, necessary activities, that it's really a, in Japanese you'd say it as, you know, it's a posture towards living. It's a certain orientation, I guess, more in English,
mm-hmm.
a certain mm-hmm. orientation. And that, you know, healing happens in the moment, and you always have a choice. You can heal in the moment. And knowing that's possible is very powerful.
Yeah. Well, are there any other things you want to make sure you bring up or say to our audience today? I'm just kind of aware of the time, and I know your dog's probably dying to get in your lap. but I want to make sure you get a chance to cover.
Oh, he just got in my lap.
There's the invitation. Finally. He's been so patient.
Yeah. Oh, God. No.
That's healing in the moment.
Yeah. That's so funny. I think we covered all the points I wanted to make sure we covered. Maybe not as eloquently or in a way that communicates ideally, but
I think you did a wonderful job. Thank you so much. And you really covered a lot of ground. That's just a lot, so thank you.
Well, and if I could summarize some of what I heard for people who would like to make this very practical, if a person with the symptoms of Parkinson's wakes up in the morning and they find it very difficult to put their clothes on, and it's a challenge to be able to walk into the kitchen to make their regular tea in the morning, and they're having difficulty making their tea so their motor functions are not quite working like they'd like them to, one of the recommendations you would make is to have a set ritual that they could do. And, for example, they could bow when they are having that difficulty, and they could say a mantra that is a mantra that's special to them. In other words, two things they could automatically do in that moment. Do I have that right? Is that the idea?
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say, I mean, even if bowing is hard, I would just say if you can try and get your fingertips touching, and just lay there with, and, yeah, I think laying there with a, saying a mantra, something you've decided, you know, that you, when you say you feel connected to something bigger, something that you can, that helps you breathe into the moment, and not begin that cycle of wishing it were different,
mm-hmm.
and not getting angry that it is the way it is, and not making you feel alone. Those are the three things that are so easy to stumble into, and anything to put the brakes on those three things. And it could even be just, you breathe, even if you can't find the words, but you breathe with a sense of, you know, I am connected and I am okay.
Yeah, well,
oh, that's
good. Yeah, it sounds like no matter what your body's doing, that is something you will continue to do. You will breathe and you can think those words. So that's wonderful. Yeah. I'm sorry, Robert, I cut you off.
I was just going to say that's quite beautiful, and what a wonderful recommendation for people. Well, it looks like our time is up, and I want to thank from the bottom of my heart Dr. Paula Arai for being our guest today, and Nancy Wells for being the inquisitor and asking such provocative questions. Thanks
Please,
to both of you so much.
Don't say that to an ex-Catholic. It's scary. Well, you're very welcome, and thank you so much, Paula. I look forward to reading your book.
Thanks for writing. Well, thank you both so much for doing this for all the people. It's wonderful, and I'm delighted to be working with you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. It's an honor for us. And that's what's happening at Parkinson's Recovery on the shores of the Puget Sound, where all the men are handsome, all the women are smart, and all the children are loved. Know that all of you are on the road to recovery, and a good day to you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.